This panel is now ready for the second case on today's oral argument calendar, and that case is number A21-573, Beth Leo. My pronunciation could be corrected, versus Dedicated Logistics Services. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Darren Knutson, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Beth Leo. Ms. Leo is a former employee of the respondent Distributed Logistics Services, commonly referred to as DLS, in ordinary course of business and then also throughout this litigation. In any event, there are two issues in this case. First, is there a genuine issue of fact over whether DLS was aware of Ms. Leo's disability and need for an accommodation? And secondly, is there a genuine question of fact over whether DLS in fact provided a reasonable accommodation for Ms. Leo's disability of clinical depression and anxiety disorder? And in our view, the answer to both of those questions is that there are genuine issues of fact that need to be resolved at trial, and that summary judgment on those issues was inappropriate. I will turn to the first issue, which is whether DLS was aware of Ms. Leo's disability and her need for accommodation. And the difficulty here, or at least the source of the controversy, is the fact that Ms. Leo did not at any point say, I need you to change some things about the way my work is handled because of my clinical depression and anxiety disorder. However, what she did say was she did explain to her immediate supervisor, Shay Smozzle, that she did suffer from depression and anxiety disorder, and that she had a particular problem when, people would talk about her and she would become self-conscious. It would keep her awake at night, worrying about what was going on and what the significance of the comments were. And combine that with the fact that during work, Ms. Leo, whose job was an accounts payable analyst, basically she was in charge of trying to collect accounts for DLS. She called upon DLS customers across the country from coast to coast and attempted to bring, past due balances down. And during the roughly 9 months that she worked at DLS, she accomplished quite a bit in that regard and was really quite effective in collecting those accounts. But what happened was that Mr. Smozzle, her immediate supervisor, would be constantly sending her emails, approaching her, interrupting her work with questions about accounts that, were not in need of urgent attention.
Mr. Knutson, can I interrupt just because I think we're familiar with those facts, and I want to focus your argument on what I think is the key issue, and that is, it seems like there's a difference between your argument and respondent's argument. Your argument seems to be saying, one, the employer, her supervisor, knew of her disability. Two, separately, she was making a request for certain accommodations. That's enough to put the employer on notice that she is seeking an accommodation, a reasonable accommodation for a disability. Respondent's argument is that the employee's burden is to do more to tie together to show a causal connection or some type of connection between this disability and the request for an accommodation, and to be a little bit more explicit in what's being requested and why, rather than to require the employer to connect the dots. It seems like that's kind of the basic issue. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes, I would, Your Honor, and I appreciate
Okay, and I'll let you speak in a minute, but it seems to me that Minnesota law on this subject is probably limited to the Hoover case. Seems to me that the facts of Hoover, the plaintiff employee in that case did more than your client did, and it seems like there's frequent reference to Eighth Circuit case law, and it seems to me that Eighth Circuit case law requires more. I'm thinking of the Wallen case especially. So why has your client satisfied the legal requirement as expressed either in Hoover or in the Eighth Circuit case law?
Well, I think she's satisfied it. She satisfied it because she testified in her deposition that she told Mr. Smozzel when she asked that they have these weekly meetings where the non-urgent accounts could be addressed and she could answer these questions and limit the interruptions to instances where there truly was some urgency, to where the matter couldn't wait until, you know, the weekly meeting, that would reduce her anxiety. And she testified that she told Mr. Smozzel that his way of his behavior and the constant questioning and berating and criticizing her performance in front of the rest of the workers in the unit, she said it drove, she told him, it drives my anxiety crazy. And so, and she told him the reason she was asking for the weekly meetings was so that he wouldn't have, you know, so that he wouldn't constantly be doing that and driving her anxiety crazy. And so she didn't say, I need this because of my anxiety disorder, but she did say, what you're doing now drives my anxiety crazy. It makes it worse. And she explained to him the connection between the anxiety and the insomnia and how that on occasion resulted in her oversleeping and coming in late.
Isn't it true that, I mean, even a person not diagnosed with a condition in the DSM could have anxiety? I mean, anxiety is not necessarily I could have anxiety, and I mean, any of us could have anxiety, but that's different from having a disability based on an anxiety disorder, right?
Well, that's true. But for purposes of this appeal, the respondent has not said that Ms. Lehu is not disabled as a matter of law. The basis for the summary judgment was whether Ms. Lehu had made DLS aware of her disability and need for accommodation. And the fact is, I guess if we get into that issue, Ms. Lehu does have a formal medical diagnosis of a disability of clinical depression and anxiety disorder. And you're right, of course, we all experience anxiety from time to time. It's a normal human emotion. But for people who have gotten to the point where they have an anxiety disorder, it causes major limitations and alterations in their ability to cope with the world and function in ordinary day-to-day life. And so, you know, Ms. Lehu, unfortunately, you know, is in that situation,
Mr. Knutson, if I could direct you back to, I think, part of what Judge Johnson was originally talking about, this connection between the anxiety and depression disorder and the request for accommodations. So far, as best I understand it, the closest connections that you've pointed us to are the original June 13th email, where she puts the employer on notice of the disorder, right? I mean, at least enough to get to pass summary judgment, you know, issues right. for trial, maybe. So we've got the June 13th email, then we've got deposition testimony about conversations during these weekly meetings with her supervisor about how certain things would reduce her or further her anxiety. Okay, is there anything else besides those two things, just as far as evidence in the records to establish this connection?
Well, aside from Ms. Lay telling Mr. Smozzle that the way things were going, you know, would drive her anxiety, up to the crazy level, and that was greatly interfering with her functioning, and that that's why she wanted to have, the weekly meetings, to have the flexibility to, you know, work through her lunch hour, work later in the day, to make up for time lost if she did arrive late in the morning. It was, I think that under the circumstances, when she explains to Mr. Smozzle the effect that his management style was having on her, that put him on notice, it put DLS on notice.
I was looking in that context at the COSI, not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, versus Trinity Health Eighth Circuit case from 2016. Would mm-hmm. you say that those facts are more or less, how would you compare them to the notice that at least the Eighth Circuit, I think it was, said, you know, was enough to at least go to a jury?
Well, I guess it's difficult to say. I'm not sure there has been a case quite like the present one, where we have a plaintiff employee who has told her supervisor about her disability and how the disability affects her, and has also told him that the way he is managing her is aggravating that, and it's affecting her, exacerbating her insomnia, which in turn is responsible in part for the attendance problems that the employer complains about. I'm not sure that there is a case that, that is certainly right on point on the facts. And there are other cases, where the employee has specifically said, my disability needs accommodation. And that's certainly, a clearer case, clearer than this one. But I do think that given that the statutory standard is the employer has an obligation to accommodate the known disability of an employee. And I think there's enough in the record here to create a question of fact over whether DLS knew of Ms. Lay's disability and need for accommodation, because she did ask for these changes in her circumstances, and she did relate them to the effect that Mr. Smozzle's management style had on her anxiety. And so I think that that's sufficient to meet the statutory standard of, did the employer know of the disability? Did the employer know of the need for accommodation?
Mr. Knudsen, are you asking us to recognize or to interpret Minnesota case law to set a lower bar than federal law?
No, I'm not. I think at least to, as I understand federal law in the area, it follows the same general standard. It's just a matter of applying the recognized standard to a particular set of facts. And I think, as I said, in this case, this isn't as obvious a case as some, but I think that there is sufficient evidence in the record to at least create a question of fact.
So we could
over those issues.
So we could assume that Minnesota law is consistent with equivalent to the federal law as expressed by the Eighth Circuit and other circuit courts.
I think that's right. I think the courts, the Supreme Court here and this court have generally said that accommodation cases under the Human Rights Act follow the same standard as set under the federal Americans with Disabilities Act. And I'm not arguing that there should be any change from that. I just think that the existing standard applied to these facts requires that a summary judgment be reversed.
I have one more question on that, and then I'll see if my colleagues have a question for you. But is there any precedential law in Minnesota other than Hoover that speaks directly to this issue?
If there is, I was unable to find it, Your Honor.
Okay. Does any other judge have a question for Mr. Knudsen at this point?
I do, I guess. Counsel, from your perspective on the law, both federally and state, is there any limitation on proving a point by circumstantial evidence?
Well, I don't think that there's any absolute bar on proving a point through circumstantial evidence. I guess it's a question of how persuasive the fact finder considers the circumstantial evidence to be.
But for purposes of surviving summary judgment, isn't that important?
Well, I think that circumstantial evidence can be good proof of a fact as good as direct evidence. And if there is a showing in the record of circumstantial evidence that would permit a rational fact finder to find in favor of the plaintiff, then summary judgment's inappropriate. And the distinction between circumstantial evidence and direct evidence, I don't think there is any requirement that a plaintiff produce direct evidence of every element of her case.
Thank you, Mr. Knudsen. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Holly Robbins. I represent Dedicated Logistics Services in this appeal by Ms. Beth Lehu. And the claim on the table, as we know, is whether Dedicated Logistics unlawfully refused to accommodate Ms. Lehu. We would submit that the district court got it right in this situation and indeed granted summary judgment. Ms. Lehu did not alert Dedicated Logistics to her alleged disabilities, and she did not ask for an accommodation that she now says she sought. In fact, she rejected an offer of accommodation and cannot show that the accommodations that she now says she sought would have reasonably accommodated her in any event. She bears the burden in this case of proving that the company actually knew of the alleged disabilities, anxiety and depression disorders, that she requested an accommodation for those disabilities, and that Dedicated Logistics did not make a good faith effort to accommodate her, and that she could have been reasonably accommodated by what she sought.
Okay, but counsel, the appellant telling us is, and even the district court is telling us, is that there was a lot of circumstantial evidence demonstrating that. In fact, the district court said if she hadn't been fired that day for being 6 minutes late, she likely would have asked for the accommodation at the meeting that was scheduled later. So the district court was well aware that there were a lot of inferences from what had occurred that would lead us to that conclusion. Is the law so strict on evidence in these kind of cases that you have to have direct evidence that you actually said to the employer, I have this disability, I need an accommodation?
Your Honor, the law is not so strict that you have to use those words, but there has to be a connection that can be reasonably made in these circumstances. and that the where the employer should actually come to that conclusion. I think that, you know, the idea that she would have asked for this is quite speculative, particularly given that she put in writing the reasons why she wanted to have that meeting, and it said nothing about anxiety or depression. So there are some concerns here that if she was not, if that's what she wanted, she was actively hiding the ball. And she actually had in other circumstances asked for something when she, in June of 2018, she had the issue with her teeth and she wrote to her employer and she said, I'm having issues with this. I'm having some anxiety and depression. She did not use the word disorder. So not really putting the employer on notice that this is at the level of a disability, but rather at the level of what you kind of expect from a person when they're having these issues with their teeth. And she asked for time off at that point, and the employer granted that time off. So she knew how to ask, and she knew, and when she asked, she got what she wanted.
Aren't those points that really should be made to a jury? I mean, I'm looking at the Coates case, which also relies, I think, on Ballard, and it says employees required only to provide the employer with enough information that under the circumstances, the employer can fairly be said to know of this disability and the desire for the accommodation. So why, looking back at that case, isn't the fact that she sent this, I think it was June 13th email, plus what she's telling her supervisors in those weekly meetings about how these actions reduce her anxiety or, on the other hand, you know, drive her, I think she used the word crazy. Why isn't that enough to be enough information that at least gets us to a jury?
Your Honor, I don't think that it is enough information because you have to look at the different, were you finished with your question?
No, and when you talk about why, could you talk not only about the facts, but like we'll go back and compare it to the information given in, for an example, that case or other relevant press opinions.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Hoover case a little bit, because in that Hoover case, the plaintiff in that case brought information to her employer about fibromyalgia. She did that on at least 8 occasions, as I recall from the case. And she brought specific information about the condition she had and how it would affect her. And then she requested something in connection with that. So she didn't say, I need an accommodation. She didn't use that word, but she made requests in connection with her bringing information about fibromyalgia to her employer and on numerous occasions. In this situation, do you have a question before I go on?
Yes, okay. I would just ask you to go beyond Hoover, which was 20 years ago.
Sure.
And as Judge Johnson said, you know, we don't have more recent Minnesota case law on this. You can tell us whether you think we ought to issue a presidential opinion here, but also look and say, okay, from the Eighth Circuit case law since then, you know, which has evolved.
And I think that the Kowitz case, the Trinity Health case, which you mentioned, I think that that is also instructive. In that case, the person said, I'm having surgery and I think I'm going to need time off. There's a direct connection there. That never happened in this case. If you look at, again, at the June 8th request, the June 8th request was nothing about I need to have weekly meetings. It didn't say I need to come in late and work over my lunch hour, which is the other accommodation she has said she needed. It doesn't say anything about that. It says I'm having this isolated issue with my teeth and I need some time off. And that was granted. When the employer was on notice that she needed something, I would say that request may have been more like the Trinity Health Coates request than anything having to do with needing a weekly meeting, which incidentally, she was given. I mean, Mr. Smazel indeed had those meetings with her, and I think they may have not seen eye to eye on exactly how well they went or how well that was working. But regardless, he did actually say, okay, we can have those meetings. That will be helpful. She recognized that for a period of time, it was helpful. I would also note that, you know, I'd like, you know, the record does is important here because there are a number of places where in the briefing it says that she talked about her anxiety and depression disorder, that she talked about insomnia. And that's not actually what the record says. There's no mention of disorder. And in fact, her telling Mr. Smuzzle insomnia, I don't think he told her that, she told him that either. She did make this one comment in the record where she says, I told him it drove my anxiety crazy. Well, I would submit that that's the kind of thing that most, maybe not most, but maybe more than 50% of employees have said about their employer at one point or another. And for an employer, every time an employee says, my employer's making me crazy, to have to think, oh, I better, I need to think about whether I need to accommodate this. I don't think that's what the law requires. I mean, the case law is that we have, and the case law that's been submitted in this, in the briefing, pretty much across the board says the it is on the employee to make the employer, to make it known to the employer what the condition is and what is needed because of that condition. And Ms. Liu never did that here. This one incident where she says anxiety and depression is really about her teeth and is not connected up at a later time to needing to talk to her employer on a weekly basis. I would also note that that issue of talking to her employer on a weekly basis is not something that she has any support for other than her own speculation that it may be effective. And that is another element that she needs to prove. And there's no, there are no facts other than her own speculation that would support that. She has no doctor's note. She has, she did have some records from her medical provider regarding her anxiety and depression, but there's nothing that indicates that that's what's going to help her. I would also note, you look like you have another question. No?
I was just trying to figure out where that argument fit in to the issues before us. I thought it was there enough to put the employer on notice that she was requesting an accommodation was the first one, and that whether the accommodations that were provided, if we assume that the answer to the first question was yes, were adequate. So could you explain where that argument you just made kind of fit in to those two issues? Or maybe I'm reading the issues wrong.
Yeah, no, it's another element of the accommodation claim, which is laid out, I think, in the product fabricators case, that she needs to show that she would have been reasonably accommodated. It is addressed briefly in the briefing. I think that the briefing does concentrate mostly on this question of the connection, because that's what the district court, that's where the district court found an issue. I would submit, and we have submitted, that indeed this fourth element is also not met because she cannot support a claim that this accommodation would have been effective. And in fact, the employer offered accommodations to her that she just rejected. So for example, when we get into the issue, because she also says that she asked to come in late, asked to work over her lunch hour. The request to work over her lunch hour was only in reference to the issues with her teeth, with needing to take time off for her dental appointments. And when she made that request, it was only for that purpose. She didn't say, I need this so that I can come in late. She did come in late frequently, and she stated that she came in late for all of these reasons that had nothing to do with anxiety and depression. That it was traffic, it was her neighbor, it was a contact that popped out. She overslept. So all of these things that
she did. Wait a minute, though. If she's dealing with insomnia, oversleeping mm-hmm. would be definitely connected to that.
I don't think there's anything in the record where she told Mr. Smizel that she was experiencing insomnia. Having looked at some of the citations from the plaintiff's briefing or the appellant's briefing, they do not support the idea that she told him that she had insomnia. And she, you know, there are these instances where she overslept and did not come in an hour until an hour and a half late. But there were a number of other incidents leading up to that where she was late because of these other issues, which she said were the truthful reasons, like because of traffic. And in addition to that, again, the employer offered her, Mr. Smazel offered her to change her schedule, to have a later schedule and come in at a later time in the day. And she rejected that. So, and the case law, which is cited in the briefing, is also clear that an employee doesn't get the accommodation they want. They get an accommodation that is reasonable and that may lead to allowing them to do the essential functions of their job. And so he offered her this accommodation, she rejected it. And once again, this kind of goes to this idea that she's hiding the ball here. You know, if he's saying, okay, do you need something? Do you want to come in late? No, I don't want that. I want to work over my lunch hour. And that's what she did because that's what she wanted to do. Ms. Lay really, I think, wanted to be able to come to work when she wanted to. She wanted to be able to be free from having her supervisor talk to her during the day and ask her questions and send her emails, which is part of normal work life. And
Ms. Robbins, I have a question about, so on the issue of whether the plaintiff employee requested an accommodation, is the analysis any different with respect to, on the one hand, physical disabilities or, you know, disabilities that might affect gross motor function or things that are more visible, and on the other hand, mental or psychological disabilities, which are not visible?
Actually, there is a little bit of a difference.
You're muted now. You're muted. You've been muted for about 10 seconds or so.
I apologize. The Wallen case actually addresses this. It says when the disability is not open and obvious, which is often the case with mental health issues, and it refers to mental health issues, the burden is primarily on the employee to specifically identify the disability resulting limitations and also to suggest the accommodation. So this, I would say, is a situation that fits well into that framework that is mentioned in the Wallen case, which I know is an Eighth Circuit case, but I think is instructive in the Minnesota courts.
Does any other judge have any questions for Ms. Robbins?
If I may, Judge Johnson.
Yes, you may.
Ms. Robbins, going to that comment you just made about the Eighth Circuit precedent, or not precedent, Eighth Circuit cases, neither party here availed itself of the opportunity we have now under our rules to comment about whether or not when we issue an opinion, it should be precedential or not. Perhaps you could briefly address that for me if you have an opinion about that, and I would ask Mr. Knutson to consider doing the same.
Your Honor, I would say I hadn't given it a lot of thought, but I do think that that an update to the Hoover case is relevant here, and that this case is a very good example of one where the employee has not given sufficient information to the employer to support the accommodation that's requested, has not given enough information either about the supposed disability or about the required accommodation or the requested accommodation, and has not made the link between those sufficient to allow the employer to fairly make a decision. I mean, this puts on the suggestion of Ms. Liu puts on the employer a real burden to guess at their employee's mental health. And I think that's a dangerous thing for employers to do.
Thank you, Ms. Robbins. Your time has expired. And thank you. Mr. Knudsen, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I will respond to the question about whether a precedential opinion would be helpful. And I think it would. The Hoover case really is about the only Minnesota case that addresses this kind of situation. And I think a further clarification of the law would be helpful in this particular kind of factual situation. There are several things I'd like to respond to. First of all, while we have referred to the June email that Ms. Liu sent to her supervisor when she did have the problem with her teeth, but her discussion or her mention of depression and anxiety disorder was not, I have anxiety just because I've had my teeth out. She talked about the implications of that for her underlying or general condition of depression and anxiety. And that's not the only evidence in the record that she told Mr. Smozel about her disability. In fact, she also testified that, when she became, after she had been there for a while, all the workers in her unit who were in kind of an open sort of bullpen area talked generally about a variety of things. And she did discuss some of the difficulties that she had faced in the past because of her depression and anxiety. And Mr. Smozel was there too. I mean, his cubicle was just a few feet away from her, within clear earshot. Now,
but isn't the real issue though whether she ever made clear that she wanted an accommodation and what that would be?
Well, yeah, that is an issue, and I think she did make it clear when she told Mr. Smozel that, you know, the way you are managing me, the way you are acting day to day, interrupting me, criticizing me in front of everyone on things that really are not urgent, and it's driving my anxiety crazy. So can you please, have these weekly meetings? And that's another point I wanted to respond to. It is true that Mr. Smozel said, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea, weekly meetings." But he didn't actually follow what was suggested. He didn't stop with the constant interruptions during the week. The point of the weekly meetings was so he wouldn't have to be doing that. He could save up the non-urgent things, but he didn't do that. At least that's Ms. Liu's testimony. And at this point, you know, we have to take that at face value. The other thing I guess I wanted to say is that the question about, you know, did she request accommodations? Well, you know, she was trying. She relied on Smozel, which was in retrospect a mistake. She relied on him to set up a meeting with DSL's human relations department. And, that didn't happen. It got put off, and when it didn't happen for a week and he claimed that he hadn't heard back from HR, well, she had an anxiety attack and that caused additional problems. But when it came time for when Mr. Smozel wanted to impose discipline on Ms. Liu, then he got a meeting with HR the very same day. Well, I think that, you know, there's some reason to believe, and I think there's support for an inference, that Mr. Smozel didn't want the Human Relations Department to get involved because he knew that there were going to have, something would probably change as a result. And in any event, the fact is, Ms. Liu did ask for a change in her working conditions, and she did relate it to her anxiety. And so there is a, you know, a causal connection. I guess if she had asked me in advance, what should I do about this? I would have advised her, tell them I need an accommodation for my anxiety disorder disability. But Ms. Liu is not a lawyer, and she's just somebody trying to make her way in the world. And I think that she did communicate enough to DSL for them to be on notice of her disability and her need for accommodation or request for accommodation. Unless you have questions, I guess my time is up.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Knudsen. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.